This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Earlier this week, Terry spoke with Howard Norman, whose new novel, The Bird Artist, has been nominated for a National Book Award. Here's Howard Norman reading the opening paragraph from the book, which introduces his main character.
My name is Fabian Voss. I live in Witless Bay, Newfoundland. You would not have heard of me. Obscurity is not necessarily failure, though. I am a bird artist and have more or less made a living at it. Yet I murdered the lighthouse keeper, Botho August, and that is an equal part of how I think of myself.
The inspiration for The Bird Artist came to Norman in 1979, when he was in Newfoundland researching a local graveyard. He was staying in an old church where he saw a painting of a water bird. When Norman inquired about the artist, he was told it was a man whose story was similar to that of Fabian Voss. Norman was also nominated for a National Book Award for his novel Northern Lights, and he has a collection of traditional Eskimo and Indian stories called Northern Tales. If it sounds like the North is a theme in Norman's writing, it may be because he lived for years in remote areas of northwestern Canada and Greenland. Terry asked Howard Norman to describe the setting of The Bird Artist, a town in Newfoundland in 1911.
Witless Bay is a real place, and it's on the eastern coast of Newfoundland, about an hour's drive nowadays south of St. John's. It's a cod fishing area. This would be before Newfoundland was a province, so it was still under the auspices of British rule. And it is an isolated place. It was even more so then. That is to say that the outside world came in not by radio or not by anything like that, but by schooners. And it was a lobster fishing area, fishing of all sorts, and a very tight-knit, closed community.
You know, your novel is in part about what change or what getting away means for different people. And, you know, I'm thinking apart how for some people really getting away would be moving to a place remote like this. But if you're brought up there, getting away usually means moving away from it.
I did talk to a number of people raised in this town or in others like it. And the one thing that all their accounts of being raised in eastern Newfoundland had in common was the fact that you could think years and years and years, even from your childhood into your young adult years, of how to leave. And yet you wake up one morning and realize, I haven't left. and that some of the characters, one of the things that I like to do is to show how people who are otherwise living in remote areas, isolated areas, through their behavior become even more remote.
You lived for many years in the far north. What initially attracted you to a place that you pretty well could guess was going to be pretty cold, pretty remote?
it's when I was in my middle teens, my home life in Michigan started to collapse. It became somewhat claustrophobic in a number of ways. And I think I started thinking of, as an antidote to that, kind of the most open spaces I could think of. And when I got out of high school, I signed on to work on fire crews up in Manitoba and was surrounded for the first time, not just with native people, but with this language that wasn't a written language. It was an Algonquin language. And it really represented that other world, that kind of other world view and spiritual world that I had very little of, and I was tremendously taken by it. And following that, I signed up for a kind of museum apprenticeship program and went further and further north, and before I knew it, I had just taken job after job to write children's films, and just about anything that was offered me, I took. And did that for close to 12 years.
I believe you've translated native poems into English.
Yes.
Are there concepts or things that natives have words for that we don't?
Yeah, there's a couple in particular. And there's one story that I've been trying to work on, and it was told to me by a guy named Moses Newcock, And Moses was a Caribou Eskimo man who lived north of Churchill, Manitoba. And I had worked with him over, three or four years. And I'd been translating a number of shaman stories, stories about very powerful shaman figures. And there's one I've been trying to get, and it has a concept in it which has to do with a visit to his family. And in Inuit, there's phrases which mean things like aunt exhaustion or uncle exhaustion or cousin exhaustion. We all know these things, but we don't necessarily have words for them. That is an idiosyncratic kind of exhaustion caused by relatives.
That's great. How come we don't have a word for that?
Well, you know, I'm searching, and all I can do is use these hyphens, and it's very frustrating, and I'm trying to find the right combinations. But in the story, which is ribald and funny and yet menacing because of this menacing shaman figure, he creates in people, this shaman, the feeling that they have gone through a terribly long, isolated winter with, say, an aunt that they've never liked, or an uncle they've never liked. And the power that that has is both hysterically funny at times and yet terribly, terribly horrific.
Did you ever want to not only teach some of the natives you were working with English, but teach them selected Yiddish words as well? You know, like, I'm tired of schlepping through the snow.
Well, I was in a very, very, very far north community once, and was at a weather station, and I was calling my grandmother, whose 80th birthday it was, and I was looking at five or six very elderly Inuit women sharing a meal, and my grandmother asked me what the Jewish community was like up there, and I said, I got off the phone, and I looked at these women, and they said, so, what did you talk about? And I realized I was a failed translator. I couldn't do it. I couldn't translate these cultural sayings, you know.
Writer Howard Norman speaking with Terry Gross. They'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with writer Howard Norman. His novel, The Bird Artist, is set in Newfoundland.
So what was the turning point for you when you decided it's time for me to go back to the States?
In Greenland, in 1980, I was there through the winter in Greenland. I had what I could only describe as about a month-long anxiety attack, and it was just sort of the realization that I was in a place where nobody could come and get me. And it all seemed to be such a highly claustrophobic existence suddenly, that I seemed to be tearing at the walls, and that's when I left the North. And then I met my future wife, Jane Shore, who is a wonderful poet, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Phil Levine and Fran Levine introduced us on a Thanksgiving. And when Jane and I got together, she finally said, look, what do you really want to do? You seem a little bit unhappy with things. And I said, well, I want to write novels. And she said, well, why wait? And so that really set me going, and that really made me feel that I had kind of come full circle. So it really was a deep desire to write. I'd been writing all along. I'd been writing radio plays. I'd been writing journals. I'd been writing short stories, but I didn't show them to anybody.
When you got married and had a family, you have a daughter now, what were there kind of compromises that you weren't used to making because you were so used to living on your own?
Well, I don't think any extreme ones. I think that some of those shifts had been made a couple years earlier. I think it was really a tremendous reprieve from the worry of either being drawn back into my own family, my own first family, my family of my mother and father, which had really more or less completely fallen apart. I have not seen my father in 18 or 19 years now. And also just like anyone else, wondering if you have the capacity to love and be loved, all those things that sound like cliches, but they're very powerful questions in someone's life. And so I think it was more just on the personal level, you know, Terry, rather than worrying about could I travel or would I have this freedom. I do, and I will continue to.
You mentioned that you haven't spoken to your father in about 18 years. And I'm sure this is pretty personal territory that you wouldn't want to go into, but I was just curious if your father tried to track you down after figuring out that his son was becoming well-known and quite esteemed. Your book's up for a National Book Award.
Well, I'm not sure what he's done. When I say I haven't spoken with him, that's probably doesn't embrace the level of anonymity that he has in my life now. That is to say, there has been no communication, and I guess that's one of the things that happens on occasion between fathers and sons.
In your novel, The Bird Artist, the father in that story just has a complete shift in his life toward the end through actions that I won't really explain because I don't want to give away the pleasures of the mystery part of the story. But did something like that ever happen to your father?
I'm glad you think those parts are pleasurable. I do too, but yes, to put it bluntly, I think that more or less my father was constantly going through large changes. It's just that they weren't often chronicled to us, to me as a child, or even to my mother. I think people go off into the world for periods of times, go through astonishing events and incidents, and come back and don't necessarily ever report it in any way, or it doesn't register in a conversation, even inadvertently. When I read Jeffrey Wolfe's book, The Duke of Deception, about his father who came and went, it truly was a revelation. It truly was a shock to me and a wonderful book for me to read, because while I don't think my father was a con man like Jeffrey's father, I think he had a con man's personality in that he could shift between great ups and downs and shift his moods and act like nothing was wrong when things were wrong. And even when the law was involved, it was as if nothing was wrong. But, you know, a lot of my upbringing was mainly reunions with my father rather than any steady exposure to him. Sometimes the reunions happened after a week, and sometimes it happened after a number of years. And those are really predatory on somebody's senses. That is, they, you know, running into one's father almost as if it was just an inadvertent meeting can really ambush you. I mean, it really is like an ambush on your emotions. Just when you think you're on solid ground, this person comes back. And I have felt a lot more strong about that since being married.
In all the time that you spent with Native cultures in the far north, did you find anyone who had a similar character to your father's? Is there anything comparable?
I found... this doesn't mean I mythologized my father, but I found characters in mythologies who had dual natures, if you will, that were able to lie with great aplomb and great expertise and great verve, and to exaggerate the most pedestrian kind of thing that had happened to them. And there was an entertaining and even charming quality in some of these folkloric characters. But I realized that their roots were very deep in the human psyche. And in those, I recognized my father. I never personally met anyone who would be the north, you know, the northern equivalent of my father. I don't think his behavior was all that uncommon. It is all that uncommon. It's just the only close-up example of it that I've ever known.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry, for inviting me.
We've been listening to an interview Terry Gross recorded earlier this week with writer Howard Norman. His new novel, The Bird Artist, has been nominated for a National Book Award. This is Fresh Air.